Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo's Gaelic football team on the west coast of Ireland.
When you look at the amount of times they've reached a final, you almost start believing something's not right.
Believing in the curse.
Amazing sports stories. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and in the early hours of Monday, the 18th of December, these are our main stories. There have been renewed appeals for a big increase in aid deliveries to Gaza after Israel opened one of its own crossings into the territory for the first time since the war began. The Israeli military has released video evidence of what it says is the biggest tunnel built by Hamas that it's discovered so far. And the Colombian government has welcomed a promise by ELN rebels to end decades of hostage taking. Also in this podcast...
You don't always get the things that you want, but he always gives you presents if you're nice.
The extent children are going to get a Christmas present from Santa. Trucks carrying humanitarian aid have entered the Gaza Strip directly from Israel for the first time since the Hamas attacks of October the 7th. The supplies passed through the newly reopened Kerem Shalom crossing. Aid deliveries had previously only been allowed into Gaza via the Rafah crossing with Egypt. It's hoped the decision to open the Kerem Shalom crossing will double the number of vehicles reaching the enclave each day. But Hamish Young from UNICEF says much more commitment to getting aid into Gaza is needed.
The opening of the Kerem Shalom crossing is promising, but it's important to stress it's not going to make any difference really to the overarching need for a humanitarian ceasefire. There used to be around 450 trucks working inside Gaza. Because of the war, there's now only about 120 that are functioning.
On Sunday, videos emerged from Rafah of people clambering onto trucks and looting supplies. The UN has warned that half of Gaza's population is starving. For weeks, there has been little clean drinking water or medicine. On Saturday, the World Health Organization did manage to deliver some medical supplies to Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest in Gaza. Sean Casey, the organization's emergency medical teams coordinator, said the hospital is completely overwhelmed and can only provide the most basic care to patients. James Menendez spoke to him about the latest efforts to bring aid into Gaza. He says it's only a fraction of what's needed.
There's almost nobody that I've met in the Gaza Strip, but particularly in the northern part, who isn't hungry or thirsty. Even at Al-Shifa Hospital, people with serious injuries yesterday were asking for food and water. There has not been enough supply coming in. The more trucks that come in with food and water and fuel and medicines and medical equipment, the better for this population. Everybody is in dire straits here, not eating enough, not able to access safe drinking water, not able to access shelter supplies. Winter is here and is coming. There's some very cold nights. We've had some very wet days and nights. So there's a huge need for a whole range of items. And it's great news that more will be coming across.
But still a desperate situation. I mean, how does it compare to other emergencies you've had to deal with? Is this as bad as it gets?
I think a lot of us in WHO and in other humanitarian agencies that are here have seen very difficult and challenging circumstances, very sad circumstances with a lot of suffering. I haven't seen hospitals so overwhelmed ever before, and for such a long period. I can't imagine being in the position of hospital staff with no anesthesia and no equipment, no water, trying to care for patients who are streaming in constantly with serious injuries, or being a mother who needs to deliver in the baby in these circumstances. It's absolutely horrendous, and it's among the worst many of us have seen. There's a huge level of suffering, and the only real solution to this immediately and in a sustainable way is a ceasefire. In the interim, what we're doing is providing some relief for the short term, but there's still just an unbelievable amount of suffering all across the Gaza Strip.
Sean Casey from the World Health Organization. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has restated his opposition to a ceasefire in Gaza. The Hamas-run health ministry says the death toll of Palestinians in Gaza is around 19,000. And some of Israel's closest allies, like Germany and the UK, are calling for a ceasefire if it's sustainable in the long term. While France's Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna, who's been visiting the region, is going even further.
What we are saying is that an immediate truce is necessary, allowing progress to be made towards a ceasefire to obtain the release of the hostages, to allow access and the delivery of more humanitarian aid to the suffering civilian population of Gaza. Because we must now think about the return of a political horizon to deal with this conflict.
So what is the situation regarding diplomatic efforts to bring an end to the fighting? I put that to our security correspondent Frank Gardner, who's in Jerusalem.
When this conflict began on October the 7th and Israel began its retaliation for the horrific raids by Hamas into southern Israel that killed so many people, over 1,000 people, the support that Israel got from its allies and much of the world at the time appeared to be pretty much unconditional. But that support is certainly eroding now because of the extent of the casualties that Israel's military actions are causing. You can't go into a place like Gaza and launch airstrikes, artillery strikes, drone strikes, and all the rest of it, and not expect to have high civilian casualties. And that is exactly what is happening. Even if you don't trust the Hamas-run casualty figures of 19,000 almost killed so far, even half that number would be an unacceptably high number of people to have been killed so far. So you've got Germany and Britain saying that they want to see a sustainable ceasefire leading to a sustainable peace. And you've got the French foreign minister going further than that, calling for an immediate ceasefire. In other words, in line with what the rest of the world has been calling for some time. That is resisted by Israel, specifically by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, because he says, if we give Hamas a ceasefire now, they will simply rearm, restock, and come back and hit us harder again, as indeed Hamas have vowed to do. They have said, we're not going to give up the fight. We're going to keep on when we have the opportunity. We're going to hit them again. Now, Hamas have said in the last couple of hours, here are our conditions for returning the hostages. We need an immediate and permanent ceasefire and a withdrawal of Israeli troops before we can discuss giving back the hostages. That's not the way Israel sees it. So it's all very well to talk about negotiations, but the two sides are a long way apart.
And tell us about this vast tunnel that Israel says it's unearthed.
Yes, the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, which is their word for their military, have revealed details and shown pictures of this huge tunnel complex, the biggest one so far. I mean, everybody knew there were tunnels underneath Gaza, but these are huge, they're saying, and in fact, they've shown pictures of it. They say that this is as close as 400 metres to the Eretz crossing. So above ground, you've got this formal checkpoint where in peaceful times, or more peaceful times, Palestinian guest workers were crossing into Israel to work on the farms and other light industries in southern Israel. But underneath, you had this great big military complex, big enough to drive a tractor through. And the Israeli Defence Force is saying, look at how much it would have cost to build all of these tunnels. Millions of dollars. That's money that should have been spent for the benefit of people above ground.
Frank Gardner in Jerusalem. Colombia's ELN rebels have said they'll stop kidnappings for ransom, which for decades has been one of their main sources of income. The announcement was made at the end of a fifth round of peace talks, as Leonardo Rocha reports.
The government's chief peace negotiator said the group's decision was crucial for peace in Colombia. The ELN, or National Liberation Army, has relied on abductions for money and drug trafficking to support its fight against the armed forces, which began in the 1960s. The issue came to the attention of the wider world last month when the father of the Liverpool football player Luis Diaz was kidnapped and held by the ELN for almost 2 weeks. At the end of the latest round of negotiations, the rebels also promised to provide the names of all the hostages they're currently holding.
To Serbia, where vote projections following parliamentary and local elections suggest that President Aleksandar Vučić's party will keep its majority in parliament. The projections suggest his Serbian Progressives will win almost 47% of the vote. Turnout appears to have been similar to last year's election at about 60%. A loose coalition of 15 opposition groups had united to challenge Mr. Vucic's party, which has been in power for more than a decade. These voters had only small hopes of change.
We all know why the current situation is not good. This election gave us a chance to change something, that it gets better for everyone and that we finally live as a civilised society. That's it.
I think the opposition has a very small chance. I wish it were different, because autocracy is not good.
Most of the opposition favours closer ties with the European Union rather than Russia. Just before we recorded this podcast, my colleague James Menendez spoke to our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay as counting was taking place on Sunday evening. So what were the early results?
The showing that Mr. Vucic's Progressive Party have done better than I think many people expected. It looks like they've taken something like 46% of the vote. That's according to the election monitor CESID and also the polling organisation Ipsos, who works in conjunction with CESID. And they are projecting that Progressive Party will get about 46%, and the next largest grouping is the Serbia Against Violence Coalition with about half that number of votes, 23%, and only five electoral lists in total actually passing the 3% threshold to enter Parliament. There's been something of a collapse in the extreme right-wing nationalist vote in Serbia. But, Prime Minister Ana Brnabic, when she was giving her speech after polls closed at Progressive Party headquarters, she looked extremely satisfied. And if these projections are borne out in the official results, you can understand why.
How do you explain how well they've done? I mean, my understanding was that it was opposition parties that called for this election, so presumably that tactic's backfired.
Yeah, well, that was always a danger, and that was something that I put to the opposition parties when I was talking to them ahead of the election, the Progressive Party is a very well-oiled electoral machine, which has a lot of practice at winning elections, of getting its voters out to the polling stations, and getting them to vote for the Progressive Party, whereas for the past decade or so, there hasn't been a compelling opposition proposition. They splintered after the 2012 election into various smaller parties, which there was a lot of infighting between, and people didn't really see them as an attractive alternative to the Progressives. So this coalition was interesting in that we had a coherent alternative to the Progressives, but everybody was aware that the parties under the umbrella Serbia Against Violence covered an awful lot of different interest groups, from left-wing eco-activists through to centre-right, even conservative parties. The only thing they really had in common was their opposition to the Progressive Party.
And what does it all say about the future direction of the country internationally, that sort of constant tension between leaning towards the European Union and also perhaps a little bit to Russia too?
The funny thing about this election, of course, was that both the Progressive Party and the Serbia Against Violence Coalition were saying they were pro-European. They want Serbia to become a member of the European Union. The Progressive Party can point out that the negotiations to join the European Union started while they were in government. But at the same time, President Vucic has always spoken about the importance of Serbia's friendship with Russia and the fact that there's no way that Serbia is going to recognise Kosovo's unilateral declaration of independence or engage in what the European Union calls de facto recognition of Kosovo. And this is now being written into the conditions for Serbia joining the European Union. So it's looking a bit sticky from that point of view. But I have to say, you'd struggle to find a party with a serious chance of winning seats in this election who would have made anything radically different in terms of their promises and their stances on the European Union, Russia and Kosovo.
Guy Delaunay in Belgrade. It was a significant day at one of the most revered landmarks in the French capital, Paris, more than 4.5 years after the fire that ravaged Notre Dame Cathedral. A gleaming golden rooster weather vane has been fixed to the top of the new spire as experts continue their painstaking repair and restoration of the building, which is around 800 years old. Here's Wendy Urquhart.
In April 2019, a huge blaze at Notre Dame Cathedral destroyed precious sculptures, artefacts and paintings and sent the spire crashing through the roof of the church. The rooster that stood at the top of it was later found in the debris, damaged beyond repair. On Saturday, a new rooster made from golden copper and designed by chief architect Philippe Villeneuve was blessed by the Archbishop of Paris. Sacred relics were placed inside the sculpture, including what's believed to be fragments of Christ's crown of thorns, before it was carefully hoisted to the top of the new spire. The man in charge of Notre Dame's restoration, Philippe Jost, says it was a symbolic moment.
The rooster means we're right at the end of the rebuilding of the spire. It's 96 metres tall, and once the roofers have covered the spire, we'll be able to take the scaffolding off, and that's when Parisians and everyone who walks past will be able to see this flamboyant rooster.
Notre Dame, or Our Lady of Paris, is one of the city's most iconic buildings. Construction was completed in 1260, but parts of the building date back to 1163. For the last 4 years, dozens of sculptors have been remaking and restoring gargoyles, religious icons, ornaments and foliage for the rose window and the façade of the church. Philippe Jost says great care has been taken to protect the cathedral from fire in the future.
We've deployed a number of fire safety devices, some of which are really innovative for a cathedral, including mist sprinklers under the roof, in the oak structure and in the spire. It's a first for a cathedral in France.
Pope Francis and other dignitaries are expected to be invited to the reopening of Notre Dame Cathedral, which is scheduled to take place in December next year.
Wendy Urquhart with that report. Still to come.
Surat dominates in the processing of the precious gems, with an estimated 90% of the world's rough diamonds cut and polished there before being sold on to global buyers.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has officially opened a huge new diamond exchange in the Western City.
Hello, I'm Katya Adler, and this is The Global Story from the BBC World Service.
China and America came together and agreed on this climate issue.
We're here to look beyond the headlines, peel back lazy assumptions, and give you a fresh global perspective on the stories that matter.
Is Europe tiring in terms of its support for Ukraine?
There will have to be some kind of negotiation to end this war.
Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Democratic Republic of Congo and Kenya are embroiled in a diplomatic row. It all kicked off when a DRC opposition figure used the Kenyan capital Nairobi to announce he was forming an alliance of rebel groups. The DRC government recalled its ambassador and accused Kenya of hosting subversive activities. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross told me more.
Corne Nanga is an opposition figure from the Democratic Republic of Congo who was the head of the Electoral Commission during the last election in 2018. And it seems he then had a fallout and left the country, went into exile. And then suddenly he's popped up in a hotel in Kenya alongside the leader of a well-known rebel group based in eastern Congo called the M23. And he's announced that he's launching what he kind of calls a political military coalition. He's called it the Congo River Alliance. And he says that he's managed to get together a number of armed groups, including the M23, as well as some civil society groups and other politicians, to basically oppose President Felix Tshisekedi. And the reason he says he's doing it is because over the last few decades, the governments in Kinshasa have failed to bring peace to the east. But quite what his game is and why he's done this now, we don't know at the moment.
What's Kenya had to say about all this?
Well, Kenya has basically tried to distance itself from the fact that this took place, a press conference in a hotel in Nairobi, because it is somewhat embarrassing that these figures were able to stand up and announce this rebellion, as it were. And the Kenyan foreign minister, Musalia Mudavadi, has sort of said, we are still a peaceful country. He's described Congo as a friendly nation and said that they'll investigate it, but saying that we do not have to verify who the media goes and talks to in our country. But that was in response to a very angry reaction from the Kinshasa government, which is really pointing the finger at Kenya and saying, why on earth are these rebels allowed to stand up and launch this project from Kenyan soil?
I have to say the timing's pretty interesting for this intervention, isn't it?
It is coming just days ahead of the elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The last thing that the country needs at the moment is further instability in the east. You've already got dozens of armed groups, including the M23, which Kinshasa says is backed by Rwanda, even though Kigali denies it. There is a real danger of the whole election being undermined by instability in the east, and it seems that Mr. Nanga is trying to kind of stir things up with this coalition just ahead of the election.
Will Ross, the man who has come to symbolise resistance to China's crushing repression of democracy in Hong Kong, goes on trial on Monday again. The newspaper owner and activist Jimmy Lai has been charged with colluding with foreign forces to undermine China's national security. More details from Mickey Bristow.
I come here with one dollar. I got everything I have because of this place.
This is Jimmy Lai speaking while he was still free of the debt he owes Hong Kong, where he built a clothing empire from nothing and became a rich man.
If this is the payback time, this is my redemption. If I'm in jail, I'm living my life meaningfully.
He was arrested shortly after uttering these words. His trial, the most important since China snuffed out dissent in Hong Kong, will determine the cost of that redemption he spoke of. Jimmy Lai was taken away from the offices of his Apple Daily newspaper just months after China imposed a national security law in Hong Kong in 2020. It wasn't a surprise. He'd become a prominent campaigner at pro-democracy protests, and his newspaper constantly took aim at Beijing's communist leaders. Jimmy Lai has been accused of colluding with foreign forces against China. The articles he printed form the basis of the charges against him. In one of his last interviews before his detention, he told the BBC why he decided to take on the men who rule China.
You know, if they can induce fear in you, that's the easiest way to control you. That's the cheapest way to control you, in the most effective way. And they know it, and they're very good at it.
Jimmy Lai has already been in prison for 3 years, waiting for this trial to start. He's held in solitary confinement and allowed outside to exercise for just 50 minutes a day. His son Sebastian, who lives outside Hong Kong, was shocked when he saw recent snatched photographs of his father.
He was skinnier, darker, led around by two men. And it's just a reminder that he's 76 and he's been in solitary confinement for 3 years. It was pretty heartbreaking, but it was also the first time I saw him in 3 years. So in that sense, it was bittersweet. I think anybody who sees a picture of their parents feels a bit of happiness.
Jimmy Lai is pleading not guilty, but no one believes he'll win, as his son made clear when asked of his feelings about the trial.
I'm reflexively anxious, but there's actually no anxiety involved once you think about it, because it's a complete show trial. The result is already predetermined. It's a trial with three government-appointed judges, no jury, and the security minister recently boasted of a 100% conviction rate.
China says the charges against Jimmy Lai are simply about upholding the law, but the authorities in Hong Kong appear nervous about the trial, which has been delayed on a number of occasions already. This is Hong Kong security chief Chris Tang, warning anyone attending court not to disrupt the proceedings, which will be watched closely around the world. Just a few years ago, Hong Kong was convulsed by pro-democracy protests, but China has now crushed all anti-government activism. The verdict in the trial of Jimmy Lai will show the world just who now controls Hong Kong.
Mickey Bristow. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has officially opened a huge new diamond exchange in the western city of Surat. The complex will contain a state-of-the-art customs facility, retail space and vaults for international banking. Here's Elettra Naismith.
The Bourse in Narendra Modi's home state of Gujarat is housed in what's said to be the world's largest office complex. It aims to centralise the industry under one roof, cementing Surat as the world's diamond capital. While Mumbai has long been an export centre for diamonds in India, Surat dominates in the processing of the precious gems, with an estimated 90% of the world's rough diamonds cut and polished there before being sold on to global buyers.
Next to Scotland and Britain's most northerly inhabited island is a step closer to becoming the heart of the UK's space industry. The Civil Aviation Authority has granted a licence for vertical rocket launches at the Saxavord spaceport on the island of Unst. BBC Scotland's science correspondent Laura Goodwin has more.
Unst in the Shetland Isles, home to around 700 people and now the UK's first licensed spaceport for vertical launches. Construction has been underway for some time. One of three huge launch pads is already built. But getting the green light from the regulators is a huge moment. Here's Debbie Strang, Saxavord Spaceport co-founder.
Disbelief in a way that it's finally come through because we've been waiting for it for so long. It has been such a journey. To finally have it is a huge sense of relief.
The licence allows up to 30 launches a year, with rockets taking small satellites into space. Here's Frank Strang from Saxavord Spaceport.
That's probably twice as many as any other prospective spaceport in Europe. And it's certainly over three times as many as some of the spaceports in the US. So it gives us a real fighting chance at building a sustainable business.
The CAA say rigorous safety and environmental conditions were a key part of their approval. Suborbital launches will begin next year, with full launches planned for 2025.
Laura Goodwin. If you were looking for somewhere to stage a music festival, then Timbuktu might be among the last places most would choose. As well as being deep in the desert of Mali, it's been blockaded since August by militants from an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. Getting water and food in has been difficult, and security has been made even worse since the UN peacekeeping mission left the country. But as Sara Manetta now reports, for many reasons, the show has gone on.
In the ivory shadow of the Monument of the Peace in Timbuktu, musicians coming from all over the country take the stage as the sun sets on the sand-colored houses of the historical city in the desert. Dozens of local traders and artisans showcase their products in a colorful row of stands. It would seem this edition of the festival is no different from previous years, but that is not the case. Since late August, Timbuktu has been under blockade by the jihadist group Jenim. The villages just outside the city have become a battleground.
The festival was born in the community as a response to the tensions and the difficulties to promote life.
Salah Maiga is the director of the festival and a member of the National Transitional Council, Mali's interim parliament. I ask him why he decided to carry on with the event this year.
Now it's needed more than ever because it's something to help people lift their spirits and it brings a lot of support to the local economy. This year, we have an even bigger attendance than in the past because since September, there's been a stop to normal life.
Over 136,000 people live in the city. About half of them are children. They have endured months of sporadic access to supplies. Food and petrol prices have skyrocketed. And there's been a growing number of attacks on civilians, the most shocking one in September on a riverboat crammed with people trying to leave the city. 49 were killed.
We have to reduce our movement. We have to reduce the exposure of the team.
Aissami Abdou is from Médecins Sans Frontières. He is worried the blockade is preventing them from helping those in need.
The second concern is access of the population and the patient to healthcare structures, because due to years of ongoing conflict, the healthcare access remains already an issue.
In 2012, this region was at the centre of a Tuareg separatist rebellion. Jihadist militants affiliated to Al-Qaeda also fought against the central government, vying for control of northern Mali. French troops were deployed here for a counter-terrorism operation, and a UN peacekeeping mission, MINUSMA, was also established. But when the military junta took power with a coup 3 years ago, they made it clear these troops were no longer welcome. They said they had failed in their objectives. This week, MINUSMA officially ended its mission in Mali. But soon after the military bases in Timbuktu were handed over to the army, militant groups launched their attacks. The Malian army has called in the Russian Wagner Group to help fight the insurgents in the north, but that has added to the distrust of some local communities.
The government is under pressure. They took a huge bet on forcing the UN forces out of the country, claiming they would be able to maintain security.
Ulf Lessing heads the Sahel program at the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, a German think tank.
Despite all the fighting that's going on, the Malian government has decided to support the festival in Timbuktu. It even deployed a military plane to transport logistics. Why do you think that is?
In Timbuktu is just rather symbolic. This festival gives them some kind of legitimacy, it gives a sense of normalcy that everything's under control. The government doesn't need the UN and they're able to ensure the well-being of citizens.
Thanks to the intermediation of local community chiefs, Janem had agreed to ease the blockade of Timbuktu and let food trucks in. But on the day of the inauguration of the festival, the group issued a statement accusing the army of exploiting the lifting of the blockade and saying it would reinstate it. On that day, I messaged Mr. Maiga to ask him if Janem's statement changed his plans at all.
Our main goal is to fight for unity. We do all we can to facilitate dialogue and exchanges, and we continue to do it whatever the circumstances, whatever the challenges. We show our resilience as a steady and proud community.
That report from Sarah Manetta. Now, with Christmas upon us next week, the threat of getting no presents from Santa Claus hovers over children right around the world, encouraging good behaviour. But is it OK to use the so-called naughty list to keep children in line? Stephanie Prentice has been investigating.
A time for giving and spending time with loved ones. Children all around the world are gearing up for Christmas Day and the prospect of presents. But the deal, generally, is that they have to behave well to get a visit from Santa. And if they're not good, the threat of getting coal in their stocking.
You don't always get the things that you want, but he always gives you presents if you're nice. So we've got a Santa cam in our classroom, and my table's right next to it, so I have to be extra nice because he's got a really close eye on me.
So a Santa cam being used in that school as an all-seeing eye on children's behaviour, suggestive of a higher power and fitting for a Christian holiday. But is it right? We went to the top and asked Reverend Canon Anne East what she thought.
I think the whole message of Christmas is that God gives to everybody just because we're us. And I'd rather have carrot than stick. And because you've been given presents, you will want to give other people presents.
So is there any merit to the system where bad behaviour could result in no presents or the dreaded coal?
Children need to understand that if you make the wrong choice, negative things do happen. But I think I'd rather emphasise the positive. I mean, if you have to have a mock camera, OK, but let's say we're looking for good works. We're looking for generosity and kindness and friendliness.
Generosity, kindness and friendliness, good to aim for at any time of year. And for children, in the next couple of weeks, it certainly can't hurt to be more nice than naughty.
That report by Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Ehrlich. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Qureshi. And until next time, goodbye.